As a former Yale University professor, as I was back in my youth, I still take a kind of wondrous pride in some of the strange things that happened at Yale. In the year, what year was it, 81 or 82, a bright young lady from Chicago got a bachelor's degree in, I think, essentially English and English literature. She then went on to be one of our leading public economists. How, Amity Schles, does that sort of thing happen?
Well, thank you for saying that. Economics is just common sense, and you don't necessarily need several doctorates to look at the economy. But I also had a wonderful time at the Wall Street Journal for many years. So that's a trade school, the Wall Street Journal, in economics.
So you picked up a good deal of your economic orientation and knowledge from colleagues at the Wall Street Journal.
From the Wall Street Journal itself, and from seeing how much economics matter to the rest of life. So I guess that's life experience, just like starting a company or traveling to a place where an economy doesn't work, that wakes one up.
Well, as you know, I'm very interested in and very impressed by the major books that you have done. Just to quickly review, the first one was titled Germany, The Empire Within. It was about Germany's national identity. As reunification had just occurred. The Greedy Hand, How Taxes Drive Americans Crazy and What to Do About It, a title that will live forever. And next came a very important book that we discussed on the radio quite a while ago, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. And now, just published to almost universal plaudits, is your biography of C.C., Calvin Coolidge, of which Alan Greenspan, everyone remembers Alan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, he writes, history has paid little attention to the achievements of Coolidge because he seemed to be unduly passive. Yet Amity Schles, as his biographer, exposes the heroic nature of the man and brings to life one of the most vibrant periods in American economic history. Quite true and quite correct. And you know, as a mere psychologist, reading the book, it occurred to me that Coolidge's passivity was a bit of a put-on. He was, in a way, a tease. And much of the stuff that confounded some of the sophisticates of Manhattan or even of Washington was really just his tweaking those who were his associates and tweaking the journalists because they did not really understand how much he knew and how competent he was in what he knew.
Well, Milt, that's very astute. Coolidge was a ham. He was from New England, and he knew that, and this was in a period when the sort of the regional type was important. People recognized them. Humor was based on regional types, you know, what the Midwesterner said to the New Englander and so on. And Coolidge hammed it up as New Englander because it served him politically. Specifically, he found if he were more quiet, like a New England farmer, he would have to give out less political gifts, fewer political gifts to the mendicants who come to a political executive. Yeah. So it was an act. It was also temperament, but it was an act as well. And you're the first radio host to recognize that. It wasn't that he was just shy or something.
No, he was putting them on just a bit, obviously. I thought of a great old story reading your book on Coolidge. It's well known, the New England farmer's sitting in front of his house on the porch, perhaps rather dilapidated porch, and a traveler comes by in a car and stops and shouts to him, "I'm trying to get to Boston," to which the New England farmer responds, "You can't get there from here." I could almost see Coolidge playing that role.
And in New England, that's true. It's as anyone who's tried to drive sideways across Vermont can testify. It was said Coolidge pronounced the word for the bovine, C-O-W, with three syllables.
How does one do that?
Cow. I can't even do it. So he hammed it up, and they didn't have much radio when he was growing up. Radio came in very late in his life. So he didn't have an opportunity to hear much else than New England until he was very grown up. And that, of course, reinforced it.
Let's look at his actual accomplishments. The quick overview of his career we might undertake first, but then we want to come to his presidency. But his career begins in essentially Massachusetts politics, and he serves at various levels until he arrives as essentially the governor of Massachusetts, no small accomplishment. And we zero in on the year 1919. Events in that year in the city of Boston commended him to all the country as a figure worth watching. Why don't you recount what that was all about?
Well, yes, that's right. Coolidge, they said he climbed the political ladder in Massachusetts. He started out as a small town politician in Northampton, Massachusetts, and went up and up. And he ended up governor, but he was a new governor in 1919, a very unsettled year just subsequent to World War One. And we had a lot of inflation at that time. We had a lot of strikes. The soldiers over in Europe, while they were there, saw that the Europeans were mounting revolutions. Maybe we should have a revolution here. Certainly there weren't enough jobs. And you want to remember that the vets, when they came home, were disabled, one third of them. And we didn't have penicillin at that time. We didn't have even great orthotics. Anything to take care of someone who was disabled, and many of them contemplated a lifetime of physical pain. Their wives did not work. So imagine this, all this is going on, and the country was in deep debt as now. And the policeman in Boston, who by a quirk of Massachusetts law reported to someone who reported to the governor, decided they wanted to go on strike because, well, they were underpaid. I mentioned the inflation. There wasn't inflation adjusted or anything their wage. In addition, their station houses were dirty and full of rats. So that was all going on. And there were rats chewing on their helmets. And they didn't affiliate with the communists or anything. They affiliated with the reasonable union, the AFL of Sam Gompers. And they went on strike. And it was a dramatic moment. They were lovable policemen, but riots ensued in Boston. And the governor and the police commissioner had to send out the guard with bayonets and everything to guard Boston and protect the stores. And this is a big story. It was tough on everyone. And what's famous about it is that Coolidge, who was then governor and known as a moderate, stood by the commissioner and the policemen were fired. And he uttered a famous line, or wrote it, in a telegram to Mr. Gompers of the AFL, "There's no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime." It kind of reverberated down history.
That rather reminds one of the first month or so of the Reagan presidency, when Reagan essentially said to striking air traffic controllers, "You do not have the right to strike," and he fired them.
That's right. Well, so the question is, these are public sector workers as opposed to private sector workers. And well, the public pay them, and they're jeopardizing the public safety, and they have a trust when they take the job. And the question would be whether Reagan actually talked to Coolidge, so to speak, read him, you know. And of course, they didn't physically talk, but if there was some sort of study by Reagan of what Coolidge had done, I think Coolidge was clearly known, so Reagan was probably aware, and I would love Reagan scholars to tell me how much Reagan knew when he fired the air traffic controllers, PATCO, about Coolidge. So there's that connection. But it was a bitter thing, and, you know, these policemen were mounted, and their horses whinnied after them when they saw them on the street. It wasn't easy to fire the policemen. It took a considerable political courage. Then, as now, the Republican Party was terrified about getting the ethnic vote, and one reason Coolidge was a success as a Republican was he got the Irish vote routinely in Massachusetts. And here he was antagonizing the Irish, that's who the policemen were, as in Chicago, yeah, big time, firing them, and very soon, very shortly, would be an election, and that autumn. So it took political courage, and you can see in his letters to his father that Coolidge was not sure he would get to stay in the governor's job because this was so tough. But what it did do, and I try to sketch this out in the rest of the book, is draw a line in the sand saying, well, the U.S. is for workers, but not public sector workers striking in a disruptive way. And when you look at the 20s, you'll see there weren't very many disruptive strikes like that by the public sector because of the precedent that Coolidge set.
But would one then interpret that his vaulting forward to the vice presidential nomination with Harding as the presidential candidate was essentially facilitated by his action in the police strike or against the police strike?
Oh, absolutely. And Coolidge knew that. He acknowledged it in his autobiography, which I don't have the text before my eyes, but he said something to the effect, without a doubt, it was the police strike in Boston that put me on the national stage. And if you wonder why, I mean, why else? It was that Wilson, who was the president at that time, Woodrow Wilson, the progressive, was waffling on the very same issue, which is public sector strikes. And, they, you know, they had a police force in Washington, D.C., and it was angry. And as I mentioned, everywhere there was inflation. So the policemen actually were underpaid. Their case was just in terms of what compensation. And Wilson was here and there. And then when Coolidge did this, Wilson sort of sat up and said, oh, yes, congratulations, Governor, you were right. And it was one of those rare moments in politics where a governor upstages a president and everyone knows it.
Of course, the nomination of Harding and of Coolidge as the vice presidential candidate is a turn away from what republicanism, that is, the works and ways of the then dominant Republican Party, was really about. If one thinks of the progressive movement that came out of the Republican Party with, to be sure, Theodore Roosevelt, one discerns already a kind of a split down the middle of the Republican Party, which I think persists to this moment. The difference between, say, Tea Party Republicanism and the other variety, as espoused by many rather timid Republican senators.
Well, that's brilliant, Milt. I'm thinking about it. There are very few hosts, too, who know all this history. So imagine the Republican Party, which was then the Progressive Party, and it had been split, with, as you say, with Theodore Roosevelt going more, you know, towards the negotiation end, say, when it came to strikers, going after companies, railroads, antitrust, and so on. And then there were some Republicans who thought after a while that maybe TR was going too far. And, of course, he cost them an election by splitting the party when he ran independently as a bull moose. Coolidge started out a progressive. You can see it in his voting pattern in Massachusetts. He even had some legislation, let's see, to break up trusts and theaters. I mean, he was a real progressive as a younger man.
That does sound like TR, doesn't it?
Right. It sounds like for theaters. Let's see. Theater trust. What's that? But as he grew older, he got kind of tired of it. And he said, well, you know, there are too many laws. Too many laws are being passed. Isn't that interesting? The quantification of it began to preoccupy him. Give administration a chance to catch up with legislation. Very interesting Coolidge line. Give administration a chance to catch up with legislation. Too many laws. He started, and by the time he got to where he was as governor, well, he wasn't quite a progressive anymore. In fact, Coolidge was famous for not criticizing other people. He was not a Fox commentator. And but he did say about Brandeis, the great lawyer, philosopher, late Supreme Court justice, who was the progressive, to some colleague or other, Coolidge wrote, Brandeis is unsafe. That was about the limit of how mean Coolidge would be. What he meant was, I think we should step back and be truly conservative, by which he meant smaller government.
Well, what we see emerging there, obviously, is executive minimalism. As governor, but ultimately then as president after the rather sudden and surprising death of Harding. That government governs best which does the least that is necessary, seems to be in a way his working philosophy.
Oh, it was his philosophy. It was also Harding's, to be fair. And to ask this before. Harding Coolidge ran on a ticket called Normalcy. which is about saying no.
Also, that also mangled a standard English word, which should have been normality, but...
Right, right. Well, that bothered Coolidge, too, because he was good at Greek and Latin.
Yes.
But Harding stuck with it, and what can you do? You know, you live with someone, and you have to accept their little language ways. Harding sort of invented his own language. He spoke of bloviating.
That's a great word.
To describe his own lectures, and he kind of popularized that, too. Well, but normalcy also earns our contempt, at least our teachers' contempt, because... It sounds like amounts to make everybody normal, like Babbitt, Sinclair Lewis, you know, a regular bull, mm-hmm. right? And we want to be creative and clever, right? We that's our academic vanity. So, but what they meant by normalcy was something else. They meant we want the environment to be normal, that is predictable, so companies can start and people can have fun for creativity. They wanted, and as I mentioned, Coolidge didn't like that phrase, normalcy, so he's just said less uncertainty.
And also, of course, less taxes, less expanding budgets, in general, frugality. Because frugality is not merely a virtue in itself, rather it tends to foster somehow general prosperity and general economic welfare.
Well, you're getting at something very important, too. Now we assume that austerity, let's say the word by its name.
Good
let's
word.
Take out this
yes.
scarlet letter, right? A, austerity, frugality, government thrift, can cause economic trouble. That's one of the assumptions we hear on the radio or TV or in the internet all the time now. Well, they didn't believe that. They said if the government gets out of the way, makes itself smaller, well, maybe the economy will grow more. And the evidence from the 20s suggests they were correct. The government stayed small. The signal achievement of Coolidge was that he kept the government the same size all 67 months when he was president. Harding made it smaller before him, and yet the economy grew 3 or 4%. I work for a project called the 4% Growth Project.
Absolutely.
As if it were a dream, they had that, and it was real. It wasn't a lie. It wasn't, you know, people got, let's see, indoor plumbing, cars. It was a good decade.
Why and how that happened is worth some closer examination. And how the frugality or austerity of the Harding and Coolidge years worked so well for the economy is a basic question that needs to be raised and answered. And that does lead us indeed to the 4% Growth Project, which you are running for the George W. Bush Institute. We'll talk about all of that as we continue. This is really, in essence, a primer in conservative economics as applied to the American scene. And we'll continue on that with Amity Schles right after we pause for this. Amity Schles is our guest on this broadcast, and she is, of course, a much noted and much respected economist of the public variety. That is, I know you've lectured at various universities and so on, but you are not an academic. You are a journalist in terms of how you earned your money. And as such, you've been really one of the major sources of advocacy and explanation with regard to conservative economics. It's interesting that you chose as the subject of your fourth, or is it the fifth book, Calvin Coolidge. Surely that was not merely out of a fondness for Coolidge in his rather odd and wry mode of down-home Yankee humor, disguised as taciturnity or passivity, but you didn't choose him merely for that. You chose him because you think he's an exemplary figure for the present time.
Well, you know, many historians or journalists, John Meacham, you know, or I think David McCullough is not a professor. So I just want to clarify that. Or we're all writers, right? A lot of us, biographers especially. Vis-a-vis Coolidge, I chose him partly because he was so different, Milt.
Mm-hmm.
For biographers, presidents are like stocks. you look for the one that's so misvalued, whose value is so far from his price in the marketplace of opinion.
Yeah.
So here was Coolidge, who's down there in the bottom, right? People think he's very silly. He's sort of a seat warmer between the Roosevelts, right?
National journalists play the game of ranking presidents. What sort of rank did Coolidge have a year or two ago?
He's usually down there in the bottom quarter, or certainly in the bottom half, and I think he belongs in the top quarter. So like it was like buying a value stock. But also, we know that our post-war economic models don't seem to work. We didn't really anticipate the recent crisis. We didn't really understand how the recovery would work. We're not happy with the quality of it. And some of that has to do with macroeconomics. So what economics did they have before World War II? What was that? And can we look at that? And in the Forgotten Man book, I did, but I also found that people like to learn through people. And here's Coolidge, who is essentially the personification of pre-war economics. He believed in the gold standard. Ooh, well, that's interesting. He believed in the government saving. That's supposed to bring downturns, we hear now. But he believed in property rights. He put property rights way up there, not as a secondary aspect thing on his agenda. Well, wow. Who was he? And it seemed to work very well. This is a decade when people not only got a lot of things, but they saw wages rise, they had jobs, the future looked bright. And so I tell the story, through a man. This book is also the prequel to Forgotten Man. So he's the forgotten president. And following him is Forgotten Man, My History of the 1930s.
If you follow simply the line of succession with regard to the American presidency, another significant Republican becomes president after Coolidge ends his term. But you rank Hoover as essentially a progressive.
That's right. And, I have a wonderful little show going with George Nash, who is the Hoover biographer, or one of the leaders. Enjoy him very much. He actually kind of resembles Coolidge, which is confusing, but he is Hoover's biographer. So George and I go along and appear in public. I think George and I would agree Hoover was a big activist. It was the part of this is temperament. Coolidge was a refrainer, the great minimalist, that I call him the great refrainer. Hoover liked to jump in. He was the smartest guy in the room. You spoke of college. He was in the first class, the pioneer class of Stanford University, and he happened to study, some of this is luck, mining engineering with great engineers who had worked in the gold rush. And he had a fabulous career, Hoover did, while Coolidge was being a clerk or something. As a mining engineer, Hoover as a young man was the best paid young man in his generation, getting gold out of the ground when no one else could across the world. So he had an incredible pride and also vanity in his work. And he rescued Belgium. We learned about this in World War I and fed starving people. He was used to running stuff and rescuing. So extremely different temperament, different brand of Republican, and there was tension between these two men from the beginning, Hoover and Coolidge.
Does the turn towards Reaganism represent a return, in a way, to the sort of Republican conservatism that Coolidge represented so clearly?
I'm not so sure. What do you think? Reagan, like Coolidge, was not afraid to say, cut sometimes, but he didn't really cut, and there was a strength to Reagan. Remember, Reagan really had a war. He had the Cold War, but it was real. There was tension, and that war, he was in that war, thinking about that war. Tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, So that was a factor in his thinking. Coolidge was not in a war and wanted to make war an even more remote. He didn't like confrontation, right? So make war even a more remote possibility by writing treaties. And I think Reagan might have criticized that. So this is interesting. Did Coolidge's treaties work out? Not always. The big one was the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which outlawed war.
Yes, in one fell swoop, they sat down and decided we shall have war no more.
Yeah, well, that's very nice.
It didn't quite take.
It's like a Simon and Garfunkel song or something.
Yeah.
But it was unrealistic then as now. I mean, the modern people would say, I found it very interesting, their commitment to it, Milt. And if you go back and look at the pact, they said, well, you know, maybe this will do no harm. Haile Selassie sent Coolidge a gift of a big golden shield studded with jewels, you know, a sort of sign of tribal respect, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And Coolidge's president sent back 4 law books. He kind of liked that, right? He's saying rule of law, reign of law, as Coolidge would have said. And then, you know, I think Reagan would have found that naive, though, sir.
Well, to be sure, the Kellogg-Briand Pact did not protect Ethiopia from the...
That's right. Well, that's right.
From the Italian invasion.
That's right. Maybe our naivety vis-a-vis Ethiopia facilitated Mussolini's bullying.
Surely.
So that would be the, you know, the real, if you want to draw it along. So I didn't get into that in this book, but I did try to explain the impulse that drove Coolidge to do this treaty. And it was astounding because Wilson had wanted a treaty, but Congress had not gone along, right? League of Nations and so on, and Coolidge did achieve this by through clever machinations of the Senate with Kellogg, also an older man, also a man skilled with cunning, tricking people into underrating him, Kellogg, who is a state secretary. And the legislative feat alone is fascinating. It's the, you know, towards the end of the book, I was going to say penultimate chapter.
But now we come to the payoff question and of the payoff portion of this discussion, I would think. So I'll pose this very carefully, but maybe even in terms of the obvious hypothetical that one would want to use to open it. Simply this, if Coolidge were here today, or if Coolidge is looking on right now and is particularly interested in the state of the American economy and its rise and fall, its difficulties, its vicissitudes, its considerable continuing accomplishments, and the way in which it has been managed by a left Democratic administration, what would he have to say critically? What would he have to say in terms of recommendations about alteration of policy?
Oh, thank you. Well, first I'll say the recommendations, and then I'll say the general answer,
yeah.
If I may, and thank
Please.
You. It's hard to know. These are counterfactuals. Coolidge died in the 30s. But very clearly, he did something. He and Harding did something that mattered a lot, which was technical. They passed a new law, the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, that gave the executive more control of the budget. And it basically enabled the sequester. You could even impound money that was already appropriated. So if a department, he noticed that departments were spending in total $175,000, and these kind of stories are in the book, on pencils. Well, if they were given 2 pencils and they used 1.5, Coolidge would say, well, I'll take my stub back. You're only using 1.5. And the same goes for battleships. So that law was very valuable. Harding passed it, signed it. Coolidge used it aggressively with General Lord, his budget man, who was sort of a David Stockman, sat in the office that was the office that we now call OMB, right? And that was extremely useful. Coolidge also vetoed like crazy. He was a regular Isaac Stern of the pocket veto, which killing laws right and left. And he didn't see this as destruction. His 50 vetoes in total, he saw it as protecting the people from the Congress, Coolidge, which is very interesting, isn't it? So that's the kind of technical thing he did. We didn't say that he brought the top marginal tax rate down to 25%. He did. That's lower than Reagan's. He balanced the budget. Reagan didn't. So that's interesting, and interesting vis-a-vis Ike, too, Eisenhower. But more generally, depending on your party, Coolidge did something that all of us can admire. He used his his refraining to establish political trust. That is, he always under-promised and over-delivered, which is the opposite of a politician today. He'd say, I'll get, 2 battleships, and then he would get 3 when he felt like it. Or I'll you know, I'll be there for your party. And he would be there not just for the party, but for the dinner. And at a time when political trust wasn't so strong, you know, Harding had good ideas, but not the temperament, and was corrupt. Coolidge came into a tarnished presidency. He rebuilt respect for the presidency, and that respect served both parties. It served Franklin Roosevelt when Roosevelt became president. Very interesting, and it's the reason Coolidge did not choose to run again in 1928. He thought that it was bad for the office if the president stayed too long, like Lord Acton. You know, power corrupts, mm-hmm. absolute power corrupts absolutely. Very interesting, no?
If he were to look directly on the works and ways of the Obama administration, and for that matter, the rather progressive economic administration that preceded, namely George W. Bush, in whose institution you are now very significantly employed, if he were to really directly examine governmental economic policy of the sort that we've had in these latter years, would he be dismayed? Or merely amused, or what?
Well, like President Bush, President Coolidge did not like to comment on the work of his successors because he knew what a hard job the presidency was.
Yeah.
I'll just say
yeah.
that. They both have that grace. And so I would just leave it at that. He really didn't like to butt in. Of course, he was for more restraint than some presidents.
But surely he would be as
good. But he knew how hard it was. One thing that I should mention that
yeah.
Coolidge and Bush have alike is they both had a terrible flood. And I believe we talked about that perhaps on your show
uh-huh.
before, because they had we had Katrina, right, back in the day under President Bush, and they had the flood of the Mississippi in 1927. And we recall now, and I've written about this in the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and elsewhere, that President Bush did not go down. And he was criticized, but Coolidge also did not go down. That's because, not because he didn't feel bad for the people, but because he respected federalism. And he really didn't want to sign a great new infrastructure spending law. He didn't want a Chris Christie moment. And so if he was going to veto permanent infrastructure, which he thought the states should supply, he couldn't go down. So the two presidents had that alike, and there was a kind of divine retribution that I cover in this biography of Coolidge, which is that the other lawmakers said, well, gee, Coolidge, our president, doesn't go down to the South, and it's troubles. It was a terrible flood, the flood of the Mississippi, because he doesn't care. He doesn't know about – if it were his own place, well, he'd call a special session of Congress, New England. And then the divine retribution was there was indeed a flood in New England, a Vermont flood as bad as the one we've recently had. And to be consistent, Coolidge had to not go, and he didn't. It was said he can't do for his own what he didn't do for others. That's what the Vermonters said in their dialect. What a story, and that's the drama at the culmination of the Coolidge book.
But let me test out one crucial prediction or a crucial interpretation. Would he not have been appalled at the piling on of national debt? A trillion here, a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. Would he?
Oh, yes. This book is about debt. So he would say the first sentence of the Coolidge book is, debt takes its toll.
Yes.
So he didn't like debt. He thought it meant the end of the United States. So he would then therefore differ from any modern politician just about.
What do you think about debt? You, Andy
Schlitz. Well, I wouldn't have written his biography if I weren't concerned about debt.
To be sure.
And we have some wonderful events going. Nice thing about President Bush's presidential center where I work is we're doing varsity high school debate, including with the Urban Debate League. The headquarters, the national headquarters for that is in Chicago. And high schoolers are getting to debate these ideas, including debt, but also trade and so on, as part of our program. So my whole goal is I care about certain things, especially looking at pre-war econ, but I want to be sure younger people, Milton Friedman said high schoolers matter a lot. I think so too. Younger people, high school and college age, have a chance to confront these ideas and sort the answers out for themselves.
Amity, as we close, as we will do in just a few minutes, let's turn to sort of the affectionate memories of this rather odd doodly-doo with his tongue in cheek, as I insist must have been the case. We have many Coolidge stories. The most famous, I suppose, is the woman who says, "We've got a bet that I can get you to say more than three words." And his famous answer was, "Supposedly, you lose." What are some other anecdotes of that sort that you treasure?
Well, that answer, I've heard that too. I think Mrs. Coolidge said that might be true. So that's as close as you get to confirmation. Another, let's see. Another good one is he could be tough. A mendicant came to him and made the case for her candidate for ambassador to England, right? To the court of St. James, right?
Yeah.
She yapped on and on and on and on, and he just was silent. Yap, 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 yap. And finally she lost her breath, and she said, "I'm sure you're aware of the merits of my candidate. I'm sure you were aware before." And Coolidge said, "Less now." That's a little mean, right?
Yeah.
It's also deterrent justice. If you train people not to talk too long, well, then they won't. He could be sharp. I like that about him. I want to mention a kindness of his, though, since I told a sharp story to close. At that time, they didn't have presidential libraries. And, you know, one of the things about the Bush Library I like very much is I get to learn all about this business. You know, what is a presidential library, how it works. I'm writing a piece about the new upgrade of the Franklin Roosevelt Library and so on. They didn't have any government money then, though, for presidential libraries. So Coolidge's friends got together, led by Clarence Barron, the owner of the Wall Street Journal, and raised money for him. That's the way a president got his stuff taken care of in those days. Today it's a team work between public and private. Then it was all private. And Coolidge collected that money. It was $2 million, which is a really good amount for the period. And wow, at the end he said, "I'm going to use this money for my wife's favorite charity, the Clark School for the Deaf." And they had heard this all along. They were raising money for Grace, but they couldn't quite believe it. The president took all the goodwill in money his friends gave him and used it to make his wife happy for her charity in Northampton, Massachusetts.
She had been a teacher of the deaf, has she not?
Right. Well, it was a situation that he was worried about his health, legitimately enough. And she was aerobic and strong and would be around for decades. And her favorite thing, where she'd started her career, was teaching the deaf at this school, a wonderful school in Northampton, had affiliations, you know, with everyone, to Alexander Bell. And he gave $2 million to the Clark School, and she became the most important lady in the town. What a gift of a spouse, long after he was gone.
Amity, I thank you so much for joining us in this new series of broadcasts. And let us make very clear that given his simplicity and the simplicity and strength of your argument about his relevance in our history, that this book has a minimalist title. It is simply Coolidge by Amity Schles. And it's a superb book, much commended by all who've reviewed it, except one sour fellow at the New York Times, but that is to be expected. So once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll hope to get together again soon on air, and for that matter, off air.
Thank you, and congratulations on the continuation of the show.
Thank you so much, and goodbye for now.